Disc 4.
She pushes the button on the wall and closes the shades. She turns off the lights and walks out of the bedroom. Just off it is a small gym, then two master closets, and a huge bathroom with a jacuzzi built into agate, the color of tiger eye. There's been no reason at all to suspect that Henry's attacker entered the gym, closets, or bathroom. And each time Lucy has walked into them, she stands still to see what she feels. Each time, she feels nothing inside the gym and closets, but she feels something inside the bathroom. She looks at the tub and the windows behind it that open onto the water and the Florida sky, and she sees through his eyes. She doesn't know why, but when she looks at that huge, deep tub built into agate, she feels that he looked at it too. Then something occurs to her, and she backs up to the archway that leads into the bathroom. Maybe when he came up the stone steps to the master floor, he turned left instead of right, and ended up in the bathroom instead of the bedroom. That morning, it was sunny, and light would have filled the windows. He could see. He might have hesitated and looked at the tub before turning around and heading silently into the bedroom, where Henry was clammy and miserable with a high fever, the blinds down, and the room dark so she could sleep.
"So you came into my bathroom," Lucy says to the beast. "You stood right here on the marble floor and looked at my tub. Maybe you never saw a tub like that. Maybe you wanted to imagine a woman naked in it, relaxing, minding her own business, before you murdered her." "If that's your fantasy," she says to him, "then you're not very original."
She walks out of the bathroom and back down the steps to the second floor, where she sleeps and has her office. Past the cozy movie theater is a large guest bedroom that she has converted into a library with built-in bookcases, the windows covered by blackout shades. Even on the sunniest day, this room is dark enough to develop film. She turns on a light, and hundreds of reference books and loose-leaf binders and a long table bearing laboratory equipment materialize. Against one wall is a desk that is centered by a crime site imager that looks like a stubby telescope mounted on a tripod stand. Next to it is a sealed plastic evidence bag, and inside is the drawing of the eye. Lucy plucks examination gloves out of a box on the table. Her best hope for fingerprints is a scotch tape, but she'll save that for testing later because it involves chemicals that will alter the paper and the tape. After brushing magna dust over her entire back door and the windows nearest it, she lifted not a single print with ridge detail. Not one. Just smudges. Had she found a print, chances are it would be the yard man's, Rudy's, hers, or that of whoever washed the glass last, so there isn't much point in feeling discouraged. Prints outside a house don't mean much anyway. What matters is what she finds on the drawing. Gloves on, Lucy unsnaps the clasps of a hard black briefcase lined with foam rubber and gently lifts out the SKSUV-30 puissant lamp. She carries it to the desk and plugs it into a surge protector power strip. Pressing the rocker switch, she turns on the high-intensity shortwave ultraviolet light and then turns on the crime site imager. Opening the plastic bag, she grips the sheet of white paper by a corner and pulls it out. She turns it over, and the eye drawn in pencil stares at her as she holds it up to the overhead light. The white paper lights up, and there is no watermark, just millions of cheap paper pulp fibers. The pencil-drawn eye dims as she lowers it, placing the sheet of paper in the center of the desk. When the beast taped the drawing to her door, he attached the tape to the back of it so the eye would be staring through the glass into her house. She puts on a pair of orange-tinted protective goggles and centers the drawing under the imager's military-grade ocular lens and peers into the eyepiece, opening the UV aperture all the way while slowly rotating the focus barrel and focus ring until the honeycomb viewing screen is visible. With her left hand, she directs the UV light at her target, adjusting it to just the right angle, and begins moving the sheet of paper, scanning for prints, hoping the scope will pick them up so she doesn't have to resort to destructive chemicals such as ninhydrin or cyanoacrylate. In the UV light, the paper is a ghostly greenish-white beneath the lens. With her fingertip, she moves the paper until the piece of scotch tape is in the field of view. Nothing, she thinks. Not even a smudge. She could try rosanolin chloride or crystal violet, but now is not the time for that. Maybe later. Sitting down at the desk, she stares at the drawing of the eye. That's all it is, just an eye. The pencil outline of an eye, iris, and pupil, fringed in long lashes. A woman's eye, she thinks, drawn with what looks like a number two pencil. Mounting a digital camera to the coupler, she takes photographs of magnified areas of the drawing, then makes photocopies. She hears the garage door go up and turns off the UV lamp and the scope and places the drawing back inside the plastic bag. A video screen on the desk shows Rudy backing the Ferrari into the garage. Lucy tries to decide what to do about him as she shuts the library door and quickly skips down the stone steps. She imagines him walking out the door and never coming back, and has no idea what would become of her and the secret empire she has created. First, there would be the blow, then numbness, then pain, and then she would get over it. This is what she tells herself when she opens the door off the kitchen and he is there, holding up her car keys as if he is holding up a dead mouse by the tail. I guess we should go ahead and call the police, she says, taking the keys from him, since technically this is an emergency. I guess she didn't find prints or anything else important, Rudy says. Not with the scope. I'll do the chemicals if the police don't take the drawing. I'd rather they didn't take it. Actually, we won't let them take it. But we should call. See anybody while you were out? She walks across the kitchen and picks up the phone. Anybody besides all the women who ran off the road when they saw you coming? She looks at the keypad and enters 911. No prints so far, Rudy says. Well, it ain't over till it's over. What about indented writing? She shakes her head and says, I want to report a prowler. Is the person on the property now, ma'am? The operator asks in her calm, capable voice. Doesn't appear to be, Lucy said, but I think this might be related to a B&E your department already knows about. The operator verifies the address and asks the complainant's name, because the name of the resident showing up on her video screen is whatever limited liability corporate name Lucy happened to have selected for this particular property. She can't remember what it is. She owns a number of properties, and all of them are in different LLC names. My name's Tina Franks. Lucy uses the same alias she used last time she called the police, the morning Henry was attacked, and Lucy panicked and made the mistake of dialing 911. She tells the operator her address, or, more specifically, Tina Franks's address. Ma'am, I'm dispatching a unit to your home right now, the operator says. Good. You happen to know if CSI John D'Alessio is on duty? Lucy talks to the operator easily and with no fear. He might want to know about this. He responded to my house the other time, so he's familiar. She picks out two apples from a bowl of fruit in the kitchen center island. Rudy rolls his eyes and indicates that he can get hold of CSI D'Alessio a lot more quickly than the 911 operator can. Lucy smiles at the joke and shines an apple on her jeans and tosses it to him. She buffs the other apple and bites into it as if she's on the phone with a takeout restaurant or the dry cleaner or Home Depot and not the Broward County Sheriff's Department. Do you know which detective worked your breaking and entering originally? The 911 operator asks. Normally, we don't contact the crime scene investigator, just the detective. All I know is I dealt with CSI D'Alessio, Lucy replies. I don't think a detective ever came to the house, just to the hospital, I guess, when my house guest went to the hospital. He's marked off, ma'am, but I can get him a message, the 911 operator says, and she sounds a bit uncertain, and she should be uncertain, since CSI John D'Alessio is someone the operator has never talked to or ever met or heard on the air. In Lucy's world, a CSI is a cyberspace investigator who exists only in whatever computer Lucy or those who work for her hacked into, which in this case is the Broward County Sheriff's Department computer.
I've got his card. I'll call him. Thanks for your help, Lucy says, disconnecting the line.
She and Rudy stand in the kitchen eating their apples, looking at each other.
Kind of a funny thing when you think about it, she says, hoping Rudy will start seeing the situation with the local cops as funny. We call the police as a formality, or worse, because it entertains us.
He shrugs his muscular shoulders, crunching into the apple and wiping juice off his mouth with the back of a hand.
Always good to include the local cops. In a limited way, of course. You never know when we might need them for something.
Now he's turning the local cops into a game. His favorite game.
You asked for D'Alessio, so it's on record. Not our fault he's hard to track down. They'll spend the rest of their careers trying to figure out who the hell D'Alessio is, and did he quit or get fired or what? Did anyone ever meet him? He'll become a legend. Give them something to talk about.
Him and Tina Franks, Lucy says, chewing a piece of apple.
Fact is, he replies, you'd have a hell of a lot harder time proving you're Lucy Farinelli than Tina Franks or whoever else you decide to be on any given day. We've got birth certificates and all the other paper shit for our fake IDs. Hell, I can't tell you where my real birth certificate is.
I'm not sure I know who I am anymore, she says, handing him a paper towel.
Me either.
He takes another big bite out of the apple.
I'm not sure I know who you are now that you mention it. So you'll answer the door when the cop shows up and have him call CSI D'Alessio to pick up the drawing.
That's a plan, Rudy smiles. Worked like a charm last time.
Lucy and Rudy keep jump-out bags and crime scene kits at strategic locations, such as residences and vehicles, and it is amazing what they manage to get away with by virtue of ankle-high black leather boots, black polo shirts, black cargo pants, dark windbreakers with forensics on the back in bold yellow letters, the usual camera and other basic equipment, and most important of all, body language and attitude. The simple plan is usually the best one. And after Lucy found Henry and panicked and called 911 for an ambulance, she called Rudy. He changed his clothes and simply walked in her front door after the police had been there a few minutes. And he said he was new with the crime scene unit and the officers didn't have to hang around while he processed the house. And that was fine with them, because to hang around with crime scene technicians amounts to babysitting in the eyes of cops. Lucy, or Tina Franks, as she identified herself on that terrible day, offered her own lies to the police that morning. Henry, also given a false name, was a guest visiting from out of town, and while Lucy was in the shower, Henry, who was sleeping off a hangover, heard the intruder and fainted. And because she tends to get hysterical and hyperventilate and may very well have been attacked, Lucy called for an ambulance. No, Lucy never saw the intruder. No, nothing was taken as far as Lucy could tell. No, she doesn't think Henry was sexually assaulted, but she ought to be checked at the hospital because that's what people do, right? That's what they do on all those cop shows on television, right?
Wonder how long it will take them to figure out that CSI D'Alessio never seems to show up anywhere except your house, Rudy says, amused. Damn good thing their department's taken over most of Broward. It's as huge as Texas, and they don't know who the hell is coming or going.
Lucy looks at her watch, timing the marked unit that should be headed this way now.
Well, what matters is we included Mr. D'Alessio so he doesn't get his feelings hurt.
Rudy laughs, his mood much improved. He can't stay irritable for long when the two of them swing into motion.
Okay, the police will be here any minute. Maybe you should scram. I won't give the uniform guy the drawing. I'll give him D'Alessio's number. Tell him I'd be more comfortable talking to the CSI since I met him last week when you called about the B&E. So he'll get D'Alessio's voicemail. And after he leaves, yours truly, the legendary D'Alessio, will call him back and tell him I'll take care of things.
Don't let the cops in my office.
The door's locked, right?
Yes, she says. If you're worried about your D'Alessio cover being blown, call me. I'll come right back and deal with the cops myself.
Going somewhere? Rudy asks.
I think it's time I introduce myself to my neighbor, Lucy says.
Chapter 13. The decomposed room is a small mortuary with a walk-in cooler and double sinks and cabinets, all in stainless steel, and a special ventilation system that sucks noxious odors and microorganisms out through an exhaust fan. Every inch of walls and floor is painted with non-slip gray acrylic that is non-absorbent and can withstand scrubbing and bleach. The centerpiece of this special room is a single transportable autopsy table, which is nothing more than a cart frame with casters equipped with swivel wheels that have brakes, and a body tray that rolls on bearings, all of which is supposed to eliminate the need for human beings to lift bodies in the modern world, but in reality, doesn't. People in the morgue still struggle with dead weight, and always will. The table is sloped so it can drain when it is attached to the sink, but that won't be necessary this morning. There is nothing left to drain. Julie Paulson's body fluids were collected or washed down the drain 2 weeks ago when Fielding autopsied her the first time. This morning, the autopsy table is parked in the middle of the acrylic-painted floor, and Julie Paulson's body is inside a black pouch that looks like a cocoon on top of the shiny steel table. There are no windows in this room, none that open onto the outside, only a row of observation windows that were installed too high for anyone to see through them, a design flaw that Scarpetta didn't complain about when she moved into the building 8 years ago, because no one needs to observe what goes on in this room, where the dead are bloated and green and covered with maggots, or burned so badly they look like charred wood. She has just walked in, having spent a few minutes in the women's locker room to suit up in the appropriate biohazard gear. "I'm sorry to interrupt your other case," she says to Fielding. And in her mind, she sees Mr. Whitby in olive green pants and his black jacket. "But I believe your boss really thought I was going to do this without you."
"How much did he brief you?" he asks from behind his face mask.
"Actually, he didn't," she says, working her hands into a pair of gloves. "I know nothing more than what he told me yesterday when he called me in Florida." Fielding frowns, and he has started to sweat.
"I thought you were just in his office."
It occurs to her that this room might be bugged. Then she remembers when she was chief and tried out a variety of dictating equipment in the autopsy suite, all to no avail, because there is too much background noise in the morgue, and it tends to boil even the best transmitters and recorders. With that in mind, she moves to the sink and turns on the water, and it drums loudly and hollowly against steel.
"What's that for?" Fielding asks, unzipping the pouch.
"I thought you might like a little water music while we work." He looks up at her.
"It's safe to talk in here, I'm pretty sure. He's not that smart. Besides, I don't think he's ever been in the decomp room. He probably doesn't know where it is."
"It's easy to underestimate people you don't like," she says, helping him open the flaps of the pouch. 2 weeks of refrigeration have retarded decomposition, but the body is desiccating or drying out and on its way to being mummified. The stench is strong, but Scarpetta doesn't take it personally. A bad smell is just another way the body speaks, no offense intended, and Julie Paulson can't help herself, not the way she looks, or stinks, or the fact that she is dead. She is pale and vaguely green and bloodless, her face emaciated from dehydration, her eyes open to slits, the sclera beneath the lids dried almost black. Her lips are dried brown and barely parted, her long blonde hair tangled around her ears and under her chin. Scarpetta notes no external injuries to the neck, including any that might have been introduced at autopsy, such as the deadly sin of a buttonhole, which should never happen, but does when someone inexperienced or careless is reflecting back tissue inside the neck to remove the tongue and larynx and accidentally pokes through the surface of the skin. An autopsy-induced cut to the neck is not easily explained to distraught families. The Y incision begins at the ends of the clavicle and meets at the sternum and travels down, taking a small detour around the navel and terminating at the pubis. It is sutured with twine that Fielding begins to cut with a scalpel, as if he is opening the seams of a hand-stitched rag doll, while Scarpetta picks up a file folder from a countertop and begins to glance through Jilly's autopsy protocol and the initial report of investigation. She was 5'3" and weighed 104 pounds, and would have turned 15 in February had she lived. Her eyes were blue. Repeatedly on Fielding's autopsy report are the words, "within normal limits." Her brain, her heart, her liver and her lungs, all of her organs, were just what they should have been for a healthy young girl. But Fielding did find marks that should now be even more apparent, because the blood is drained from her body, and any blood trapped in tissue due to bruising is vivid against her very pale skin. On a body diagram, he has drawn contusions on the tops of her hands. Scarpetta places the file back on the counter while Fielding lifts out the heavy plastic bag of sectioned organs from the chest cavity. She gets close to look at her and lifts one of her small hands. It is shriveled and pale, cold and damp, and Scarpetta holds it in her gloved hands and turns it over, looking at the bruise. The hand and arm are limp. Rigor mortis has come and gone, the body no longer stubborn, as if life is too far gone to resist death anymore. The bruise is deep red against the pallor of her ghostly white skin, and is precisely on the top of her slender, shrunken hand, the redness spreading from the knuckle of her thumb to the knuckle of her little finger. A similar bruise is also on her other hand, her left hand.
"Oh, yeah," Fielding says. "Weird, right? Like someone held her, maybe. But to do what?"
He untwists a tie around the top of the bag, opening it, and the stench from the tan mush inside is horrific.
"Phew! Don't know what you're going to accomplish by going through this, but be my guest."
"Just leave it on the table and I'll pick through it in the bag. Somebody may have restrained her. How was she found?"
"Describe the position of her body when she was found," Scarpetta says, walking over to the sink and finding a pair of thick rubber gloves that will reach almost to her elbows. "Not sure. When Mom got home, she tried to revive her. She says she can't remember whether Jilly was face down, on her back, on her side, whatever, and she hasn't a clue about her hands."
"What about Livor?"
"Not a chance. She wasn't dead long enough."
When the blood is no longer circulating, it settles according to gravity and creates a pattern of deep pinkness and blanching where the surfaces of the body touch whatever is pressing against them. As much as one always hopes to get to the dead in a hurry, there are advantages with delays. A few hours will do, and livor mortis and rigor mortis set in and reveal the position the body was in when it died, even if the living come along later and move things around or change their stories. Scarpetta gently pulls open Jilly's bottom lip, checking for any injuries that might have been caused by someone pressing a hand over her mouth to silence her, or by pushing her face into the bed to smother her.
"Help yourself, but I looked," Fielding says. "No other injuries that I could find."
"And her tongue?"
"She didn't bite herself. Nothing like that. I hate to tell you where her tongue is."
"I think I can guess," she says, dipping her hands inside the bag of frigid, soupy organ sections and feeling her way through them. Fielding is rinsing his gloved hands in the vigorous stream of water thundering into the metal sink. He dries them with the towel.
"I noticed Marino didn't come along for the ride."
"I don't know where he is," she says, not particularly happy about it.
"He never was much for decomposed bodies."
"I would worry about anybody who likes them."
"And kids. Anybody who likes dead kids," Fielding adds, leaning against the edge of the counter, watching her. "I hope you find something, because I can't. Frustrates the hell out of me."
"What about petechial hemorrhages? Her eyes are in grim shape, too grim for me to tell anything at this point."
"She was pretty congested when she came in," Fielding replies. "Hard to tell if she had petechial hemorrhages, but I didn't notice any."
Scarpetta envisions Jilly's body when it first arrived at the morgue, when she had been dead only hours, her face congested red, her eyes red. "Pulmonary edema?" she asks.
"Some."
Scarpetta has found the tongue. She walks over to the sinks and rinses it, patting it dry with a small white terry cloth towel from an especially cheap batch purchased by the state. Rolling a surgical lamp close, she turns it on and bends it near the tongue. "You got a lens?" she asks, patting the tongue again with the towel and adjusting the light.
"Coming up."
He opens a drawer, finds a magnifying glass, and gives it to her.
"See anything? I didn't."
"Does she have any history of seizures?"
"Not according to what I've been told."
"Well, I don't see any injury." She is looking for evidence that Jilly might have bitten her tongue. "And you swabbed her tongue, the inside of her mouth?"
"Oh, yeah, I swabbed her everything,"
Fielding says, returning to the counter and leaning against it again.
"I didn't find anything obvious. Preliminarily, the labs haven't found anything to indicate sexual assault. I don't know about whatever else they've found, if anything yet."
"It says in your CME1 that her body was clothed in pajamas when it came in. The top was inside out?"
"That sounds right."
He picks up the file and starts flipping through it. "You photographed the hell out of everything." She doesn't ask, simply verifies what should be accepted as routine.
"Hey," he says, laughing, "who taught my sorry ass?"
She gives him a quick look. She taught him better than this, but she doesn't say it. "I'm happy to report you didn't miss anything on the tongue." She drops it back into the bag, where it rests on top of the other tan pieces and parts of Jilly Paulson's rotting organs. "Let's turn her over. We're going to have to take her out of the pouch." They do this in stages. Fielding grips the body under the arms and lifts, while Scarpetta pulls the pouch out from under it, and then he rolls the body over on its face as she works the pouch out of the way, its heavy vinyl complaining in heavy rumbles as she folds it up and sets it back on the gurney. She and Fielding see the bruise on Chili's back at the same time.
"I'll be damned," he says, unnerved.
It is a faint blush, somewhat round, and about the size of a silver dollar on the left side of the back, just below the scapula.
"I swear that wasn't here when I posted her," he says, leaning close, adjusting the surgical light to get a better look. "Shit! I can't believe I missed it."
"You know how it is," Scarpetta replies, and she doesn't tell him what she thinks. There is no point in criticizing him. It's too late for that. "Contusions always show up better after the body's been autopsied," she says. She plucks a scalpel off the surgical cart and makes deep linear incisions in the reddish area, checking to see if the discoloration might be a post-mortem artifact and therefore superficial, but it's not. Blood in the underlying soft tissue is diffuse, usually meaning some trauma broke blood vessels while the body still had a blood pressure. And that's all a bruise or contusion is, just lots of little blood vessels that get smashed and leak. Fielding places a 6-inch plastic rule next to the incised area of reddish flesh and starts taking photographs. "What about her bed linens?" Scarpetta asks. "You checked them?"
"Never seen them. The cops took them, handed them over to the labs. Like I said, no seminal fluid. Damn. I can't believe I missed this bruise."
"Let's ask if they see any pulmonary edema fluid on the sheets, the pillow, and if so, have the stains scraped for ciliated respiratory epithelium. You find that, it supports a death by asphyxia."
"Shit," he says. "I don't know how I missed that bruise. Then you're thinking this is a homicide for sure."
"I'm thinking someone got on top of her," Scarpetta says. She's face down, and the person has a knee in her upper back, leaning on her with all his weight, and holding her hands up and out above her head, palms down on the bed. That would explain the bruises on the tops of her hands and on her back. "I'm thinking she's a mechanical asphyxia."
"A homicide, absolutely. Someone sits on your chest or back and you can't breathe. It's a horrible way to die."
Chapter 14. The lady next door lives in a flat-roofed house of curved white concrete and glass that interacts with nature and reflects the water, earth, and sky, and reminds Lucy of buildings she has seen in Finland. At night, her neighbor's house looks like an immense lantern lit up. There is a fountain in the front courtyard where tall palms and cacti have been wound with strands of colorful lights for the holidays. An inflated green Grinch scowls near the soaring double glass doors, a festive touch that Lucy would find comical if someone else lived inside. In the upper left side of the doorframe is a camera that is supposed to be invisible, and as she presses the doorbell, she imagines her image filling a closed-circuit video screen. No response. And she presses the button again. Still, there is no answer.
"Okay, I know you're home because you picked up your newspaper and the flag is up on your mailbox," she thinks. "I know you're watching me, probably sitting right there in the kitchen staring at me on your video screen, got the A-phone up to your ear to see if I'm breathing or talking to myself. And it just so happens I'm doing both, idiot. Answer your damn door or I'll stand out here all day."
This goes on for maybe 5 minutes. Lucy waits in front of the heavy glass doors, imagining what the lady is seeing on the video screen, and deciding she can't look threatening in jeans, t-shirt, fanny pack, and running shoes. But she has to be annoying as she keeps pressing the bell. Maybe the lady is in the shower. Maybe she isn't looking at the video monitor at all. Lucy rings once more. She's not going to come to the door.
"I knew you wouldn't, idiot," Lucy silently says to the lady. "I could be standing out here having a heart attack on camera, and you couldn't be bothered. I guess I'm going to have to make you come to the door."
She envisions Rudy pulling out his fake ID to scare the hell out of the Hispanic not even 2 hours earlier, and she decides,
"All right, then. Let's try this and see what you do now."
Slipping a thin black wallet out of the back pocket of her tight-fitting jeans, she flashes a badge up close to the not-so-secret camera.
"Hello?" she says out loud. "Police, don't be alarmed. I live next door, but I'm a cop. Please come to the door."
She rings the bell again and continues holding up her fake credentials directly in front of the pinhole camera. Lucy blinks in the sunlight, sweating. She waits and listens, but doesn't hear a sound. Just when she is about to flash her fake badge again, suddenly there is a voice, as if God is a bitchy woman.
"What do you want?"
asked the voice through an invisible speaker near the so-called invisible camera on the upper doorframe.
"I've had a trespasser, ma'am," Lucy replies. "I think you might want to know what's happened next door at my house."
"You said you're the police,"
the unfriendly voice accuses, and the accent is deeply southern.
"I'm both."
"Both what?"
"Both the police and your neighbor, ma'am. My name's Tina. I wish you'd come to the door."
Silence. Then in less than 10 seconds, Lucy sees a figure floating toward the glass doors from the inside, and that figure becomes a woman in her 40s, dressed in a tennis warm-up suit and jogging shoes. It seems to take her forever to get all the locks undone, but the neighbor does and deactivates the alarm and opens one of the glass doors. At first, she doesn't seem to have any intention of inviting Lucy in, but stands in the doorway, staring at her without a trace of warmth.
"Make this quick," says the lady. "I don't like strangers and have no interest in knowing my neighbors. I'm here because I don't want neighbors. In case you haven't figured it out, this isn't a neighborhood anyhow. It's where people come to be private and left alone."
"What isn't?"
Lucy warms up to her task. She recognizes the tribe of the self-consumed, curdled rich and plays a little naive.
"Your house isn't, or the neighborhood isn't?"
"Isn't what?"
The woman's hostility is briefly supplanted by bewilderment.
"What are you talking about?"
"What's happened next door at my house? He was back,"
Lucy replies, as if the woman knows exactly what she means. "Could have been early this morning, but I'm not sure because I was out of town most of yesterday and last night and just landed in Boca in the helicopter. I'm sure I know who he's after, but I'm worried about you. It certainly wouldn't be fair if you got caught in the wake, if you know what I mean."
"Oh," she says,
and she has a very nice boat docked off the seawall behind her house and knows exactly what wake is and how unfortunate and possibly destructive it is to be caught in it.
"How can you be police and live in a house like that?"
she asks, without looking in the direction of Lucy's salmon-colored Mediterranean mansion.
"What helicopter? Don't tell me you have a helicopter, too."
"Lord, you're getting warm," Lucy says with a resigned sigh. "It's a long story. It's all connected to Hollywood, you know. I just moved here from L.A., you know. I should have stayed in Beverly Hills where I belong, but this damn movie, excuse my French... Well, I'm sure you've heard all about what happens when you make a movie deal and all that goes into it when they plan on filming on location."
"Next door?"
Her eyes open wide.
"They're filming a movie next door at your house?"
"I really don't think it's a good idea for us to have this conversation out here."
Lucy looks around cautiously.
"Do you mind if I come in? But you've got to promise this is all between us chickens. If word got out, well, you can imagine."
"Ha!"
The woman points a finger at Lucy and gives her a toothy smile.
"I knew you were a celebrity."
"No, please don't tell me I'm that transparent,"
Lucy says with horror as she walks into a minimally furnished living room, all in white, with a 2-story-high glass wall that overlooks the granite-paved patio, the pool, and the 27-foot speedboat that she seriously doubts her spoiled, vain neighbor knows how to start, much less sail. The name of the boat is It's Settled. The port of call supposedly Grand Cayman, a Caribbean island that has no income tax.
"That's quite a boat," Lucy says as they sit on white furniture that seems suspended between the water and sky.
She sets a cell phone on the glass coffee table.
"It's Italian."
The woman smiles a secretive, not-so-nice smile.
"Reminds me of Cannes," Lucy says.
"Oh, yes, the film festival."
"No, not that so much. The Ville de Cannes, the boats, oh, the yachts. Just past the old clubhouse, you turn on quay number 1, very near the Poseidon and Amphitrite boat rentals out of Marseille. Nice fellow who works there, Paul. Drives his bright yellow old Pontiac, a strange sight to see in the south of France. You just keep walking past the storage units, turn on quay number 4, and go to the end toward the lighthouse. I've never seen so many mangustas and leopards in my life. I once had a Zodiac with a pretty muscular Suzuki engine, but a big boat? Who has the time? Well... maybe you do."
She gazes at the dry-docked speedboat.
"Of course, the sheriff's department and customs will nail you good if you go more than 10 miles an hour and that thing through here."
The lady is clueless. She is pretty, but not in a way that Lucy finds appealing. She looks very rich and pampered and addicted to Botox, collagen, thermal treatments, whatever new magic is offered by the dermatologist. It may have been years since she was able to frown. But then, she doesn't need negative facial gestures. for her face to look angry and mean would be redundant.
As I said, I'm Tina, and you are...
You can call me Kate. That's what my friends call me,
the spoiled rich lady replies.
I've been in this house for 7 years, and never once has there been a problem, except with Jeff, who I am happy to report is off living his life in the Cayman Islands, among other places. I guess what you're telling me is you're not really a police officer.
I really apologize if I slightly misled you, but I didn't know what else to do to get you to come to the door, Kate.
I saw a badge.
Yes, I held it up so you would. It's not real, not really. But when I'm in training for a part, I live it as much as I can, and my director suggested that I not only move into the house where we're shooting, but go ahead and carry a badge and drive the same car as the special agent does and all the rest.
I knew it. Kate shoots that finger at her again. The sports cars. Ah, it's all part of your role, isn't it?
She settles her long-legged, thin body back into the depths of her big white chair and plumps a pillow in her lap.
You don't look familiar, though.
I try not to.
Kate attempts a frown.
But I would think you would look at least a little familiar, and I can't think who you are anyway. Tina who?
Mangusta.
She offers the name of her favorite boat, fairly certain the neighbor won't directly connect Mangusta with earlier comments about Can, but rather will think that Mangusta sounds familiar, somewhat familiar.
Actually, yes, I have heard the name, it seems. Maybe,
Kate says, encouraged.
I haven't been in much. Not big roles, although some of the films have been big. This is my break, you might say. I started out on off-off-Broadway and then made the jump to off-off-movies, whatever I could get. And I just hope it won't drive you crazy when all the trucks and everything roll in, but fortunately, that's not until summer. And it may not happen at all because of this crazy person who seems to have followed us here.
What a pity.
She leans forward in the big white chair.
Tell me about it.
Oh, dear.
Kate's eyes darken and she looks worried.
From the West Coast? That's where he followed y'all from? You said... You have a helicopter?
I'm pretty sure, Lucy answers. If you've never been stalked, you can't really understand what a nightmare it is. I would never wish it on anyone. I thought coming here would be the best thing we ever did, but somehow he found us and followed us. I'm sure it's him. Pretty sure. God help me if we now have two stalkers, so I hope it's him, oddly. And yes, I travel in helicopters when needed, but not all the way from the West Coast.
At least you don't live alone,
Kate comments.
My roommate, another actress, just moved out and went back west, because of the stalker.
What about that good-looking boyfriend of yours? Actually, I wondered early on if he might be an actor, someone famous. I've been trying to figure out who he is.
She smiles wickedly.
Hollywood has written all over that one. What's he been in?
Trouble, mostly.
Well, if he does you wrong, darling, you just come see Kate here.
She pats the pillow in her lap.
I know what to do about some things.
Lucy looks out at it settled, shining long, sleek, and white in the sun. She wonders if Kate's ex-husband is boatless and hiding from the IRS in the Cayman Islands. She says,
Last week the wacko came on my property, or at least I assume it was him. I'm just wondering...
Kate's unlined, tight face registers a blank.
Oh, she then says... The one stalking y'all? Why, no, I didn't see him. Not that I'm aware of, but then there are a lot of people roaming about. All these yard men, pool people, construction workers, and so on. But I did notice all the police cars in the ambulance. It scared me to death. That's just the sort of thing that ruins an area.
You were home then. My roommate, former roommate, was in bed with a hangover. She may have gone out to sit in the sun.
Yes, I saw her do that.
You did?
Oh, yes,
Kate replies.
I was upstairs in the gym and just happened to look down, and I saw her come out the kitchen door. I do remember she had on pajamas and a robe, and now that you tell me she had a hangover, that explains it.
Do you remember what time?
Lucy asks as her cell phone on the coffee table continues to record their conversation.
Let me see. 9 or close enough.
Kate points behind her toward Lucy's house.
She sat by the pool.
And then what?
I was on the elliptical machine, she says.
And in Kate's way of thinking, everything is about Kate.
Let me see. I believe I was distracted by something on one of the morning shows. No, I was on the phone. I do remember looking out and she was gone. Apparently had gone back into the house. She wasn't out there long, my point is.
How long were you on the elliptical machine, and do you mind showing me your gym so I can see exactly where you were when you saw her?
Sure, come right on, darling.
Kate gets up from her big white chair.
How about something to drink? I believe I could use a little mimosa right about now, with all this talk about stalkers and big noisy movie trucks rolling in and helicopters and all. I usually do the elliptical machine for 30 minutes.
Lucy picks up her cell phone from the coffee table.
I'll have whatever you're having, she says.
Chapter 15. The hour is 11:30 when Scarpetta meets Marino by the rental car in the parking lot of her former building. Dark clouds remind her of angry fists flailing across the sky, and the sun ducks in and out of them, and sudden gusts of wind snatch at her clothing and hair.
Is Fielding coming with us? Marino asks, unlocking the SUV. I'm assuming you want me to drive. Some son of a bitch held her down and smothered her. Goddamn son of a bitch, killing a kid like that. Had to be somebody pretty big, don't you think, to hold her down and she can't move?
Fielding's not coming. You can drive. When you can't breathe, you panic and struggle like hell. So her assailant didn't have to be huge, but he did have to be big and strong enough to keep her down, to pin her down. More than likely, she's a mechanical asphyxiation, not a smothering.
And that's what ought to be done to his ass when he gets caught. Let a couple of huge prison guards pin him down and sit on his chest so he can't breathe. See how he likes it.
They climb in, and Marino starts the engine.
I'll volunteer. Let me do it. Jesus, doing that to a kid.
Let's save the kill 'em all, let God sort 'em out part for later, she says. We have a lot to handle. What do you know about Mama?
Since Fielding's not coming, I assume you called her.
I told her I want to talk to her, and that was about the extent of it. She was a little strange on the phone. She thinks Jilly died of the flu.
You gonna tell her?
I don't know what I'm gonna tell her.
Well, one thing's for sure. The feds will be thrilled when they hear you making house calls again, Doc. Nothing thrills them more when they get their hooks in a case that ain't any of their business, and then you show up making your damn house calls.
He smiles as he drives slowly through the crowded lot. Scarpetta doesn't care what the feds think, and she looks out at her former building called Biotech 2, at its clean gray shape trimmed with deep red brick, at the covered morgue bay that reminds her of a white igloo sticking out to one side. Now that she's back, she may as well have been here all along. It doesn't feel strange that she is headed to a death scene, most likely a crime scene, in Richmond, Virginia. And she doesn't care what the FBI or Dr. Marcus or anyone else thinks about her house calls.
Got a feeling your pal Dr. Marcus will be thrilled, too,
Marino adds sarcastically, as if he is following her thoughts.
Did you tell him Jilly's a homicide?
No, she replies. She didn't bother looking for Dr. Marcus or telling him anything after she finished with Jilly Paulson and cleaned up and changed back into her suit and looked at some microscopic slides. Fielding could give Dr. Marcus the facts and pass on that she would be happy to brief him later and can be reached on her cell phone if necessary. But Dr. Marcus won't call. He wants as little to do with the Jilly Paulson case as possible, and Scarpetta now believes he decided long before he contacted her in Florida that he wasn't going to benefit from this 14-year-old girl's death, that nothing but trouble was headed his way if he didn't do something to deflect it. And what better deflection than calling in his controversial predecessor, Scarpetta the Lightning Rod? He's probably suspected all along that Jilly Paulson was murdered, and for some reason decided not to dirty his hands with the case. Who's a detective? Scarpetta asks Marino as they wait for traffic rolling off I-95 to pass on 4th Street. Anyone we know?
Nope. He wasn't here when we was.
He finds an opening and guns the engine, rocketing them into the right lane. Now that Marino's back in Richmond, he's driving the way he used to drive in Richmond, which is the way he used to drive when he started out as a cop in New York. Know anything about him?
Enough.
I suppose you're going to wear that cap all day, she says.
Why not? You got a better cap for me to wear? Besides, Lucy will feel good knowing I'm wearing her cap. Did you know police headquarters moved? It ain't on 9th Street anymore. It's down there near the Jefferson Hotel in the old Farm Bureau building. Aside from that, the police department hasn't changed except for the paint job on the marked units, And they let them wear baseball caps, too, like they're NYPD.
I guess baseball caps are here to stay.
Huh. So don't be griping about mine anymore.
Who told you the FBI's gotten involved?
The detective. His name's Browning. Seems all right, but he's not been doing homicides long. And the cases he has worked are of the urban renewal variety. One piece of shit shooting another piece of shit.
Marino flips open a notepad and glances at it as he drives through town toward Broad Street.
Thursday, December 4th, he gets a call for a DOA and responds to the address where we are now heading in the fan, over there near where Stewart Circle Hospital used to be before they turned it into high-dollar condos. Or did you know that? It happened after you left. Would you want to live in a former hospital room? No, thank you.
Do you know why the FBI is involved, or do I have to wait for that part? She asks.
Richmond invited them. That's just one of many pieces that doesn't make sense. I got no idea why Richmond PD invited the feds to stick their noses in, or why the feds want to.
What does Browning think?
He's not particularly revved up about the case. Thinks the girl probably had a seizure or something.
He thinks wrong. What about the mother?
She's a little different. I'll get to that.
And the father?
Divorced, lives in Charleston, South Carolina. A doctor. An irony, ain't it? A doctor would know damn well what a morgue is like. And here's his little girl inside a body bag in the morgue for 2 damn weeks because they can't decide on who's making the arrangements or where she's going to be buried and God knows what else they're fighting about.
What I do pretty soon is take a right on Grace, Scarpetta says, and we'll just follow it straight there.
Thank you, Magellan. All those years I drove in the city, how'd I do it without you navigating?
I don't know how you function at all when I'm not around. Tell me more about Browning. What did he find when he got to the Paulson house?
The girl was in bed, on her back, pajamas on. Mother was hysterical, as you might imagine.
Was she under the covers?
The covers were thrown back. In fact, they were mostly on the floor. And the mother told Browning they were like that when she got home from the drugstore. But she's having memory problems, as you probably know. I think she's lying.
About what?
Not sure. I'm basing everything on what Browning told me over the phone, meaning as soon as I talk to her, I start all over again.
What about evidence someone might have broken into the house? Scarpetta asks. Anything to make us think that?
Nothing to make Browning think that, apparently. Like I said, he's not revved up about it. Never a good thing. If the detective's not revved up about it, then the crime scene techs probably aren't revved up either. If you don't think anyone broke in, where the hell do you start dusting for prints, for example?
Don't tell me they didn't even do that.
Like I said, when I get there, I start all over again.
They are now in an area called the Fan District, which was annexed by the city soon after the Civil War, and was eventually dubbed the Fan because it is shaped like one. Narrow streets wind and wend and dead end without cause, and have fruity names like strawberry, cherry, and plum. Most homes and row houses have been restored to an earlier charmed state of generous verandas and classical columns and fancy ironwork. The Paulson home is less eccentric and ornate than most. A modest-sized dwelling with simple lines, a flat brick facade, a full front porch, and a false mansard slate roof that reminds Scarpetta of a pillbox hat. Marino pulls in front near a dark blue minivan, and they get out. They follow a brick walkway that is old and worn smooth and slick in spots. The late morning is overcast and cold, and Scarpetta would not be surprised to see a little snow, but she hopes there will be no freezing rain. The city has never adapted to adverse winter weather, and at the mere mention of snow, Richmonders raid every grocery store and market in town. Power lines are above ground and don't last long when grand old trees get uprooted or snapped off by blasting winds and heavy sleeves of ice, so Scarpetta sincerely hopes there will be no freezing rain while she's in town. The brass knocker on the black front door is shaped like a pineapple, and Marina raps it 3 times. The loud, sharp clank of it is startling and seems insensitive because of the reason for this visit. Footsteps sound, moving quickly, and the door swings open wide. The woman on the other side is small and thin, and her face is puffy, as if she doesn't eat enough, but drinks plenty and has been crying a lot. On a better day, she might be pretty in a rough, dyed blonde way.
"Come in,"
she says, her nose stopped up.
"I have a cold, but I'm not contagious."
Her bleary eyes touch Scarpetta.
"Then who am I to tell a doctor that? I assume you are the doctor, the one I just talked to.
It is a safe assumption, since Marino is a man and is wearing black fatigues and an LAPD baseball cap. I'm Dr. Scarpetta. She offers her hand. I'm so very sorry about Jilly. Mrs. Paulson's eyes brighten with tears.
Come in, won't you? I've not been much of a housekeeper of late. I just made some coffee.
Sounds good, Marino says, and he introduces himself. Detective Browning's talked to me, but I thought we'd start from square one, if that's all right.
How do you take your coffee?
Marino has the good sense not to offer his usual line, like my women, sweet and white. Black is fine, Scarpetta says. And they follow Mrs. Paulson along a hallway of old pine planking. And off to their right is a comfortable small living room with dark green leather furniture and brass fireplace tools. To the left is a stiff formal parlor that doesn't look used, and the chill of it reaches out to Scarpetta as she walks past.
May I take your coats?
Mrs. Paulson asks.
There I go, asking about coffee when you're at the front door and asking about your coats when we get to the kitchen. Don't mind me. I'm not right these days.
They slip out of their coats, and she hangs them on wooden pegs in the kitchen. Scarpetta notices a bright red hand-knit scarf on one of the pegs, and for some reason wonders if it might have been Jilly's. The kitchen has not been remodeled in recent decades, and has an old-fashioned black-and-white checkered floor and old white appliances. Its windows overlook a narrow yard with a wooden fence, and behind the back fence is a low roof of slate that is missing tiles and piled with dead leaves in the eaves and patched with moss. Mrs. Paulson pours coffee, and they sit at a wooden table by the window that offers a view of the back fence and the mossy slate roof beyond. Scarpetta notices how clean and orderly the kitchen is, with its rack of pots and pans hanging from iron hooks over a butcher's block, and the drain board and sink empty and spotless. She notices a bottle of cough syrup on the counter near the paper towel dispenser, a bottle of non-prescription cough syrup with an expectorant. Scarpetta sips her black coffee.
I don't know where to start,
Mrs. Paulson says.
I don't really know who you are, for that matter, except when Detective Browner called me this morning. He said you were experts from out of town and would I be home. Then you called.
She looks at Dr. Scarpetta.
So Browning called you, Marino says.
He's been nice enough.
She looks at Marino and seems to find something interesting about him.
I don't know why all these people are... Well, I guess I don't know much.
Her eyes fill up again.
I should be grateful. I can't imagine having this happen and no one cares.
People certainly care, Scarpetta says. That's why we're here.
Where do you live?
Her eyes are fixed on Marino, and she lifts her coffee, taking a sip, looking carefully at him.
Based down in South Florida, a little north of Miami, Marino replies.
Oh, I thought maybe you were from Los Angeles,
she says, her eyes moving up to his cap.
We got L.A. connections, Marino says.
It's just amazing,
she says, but she doesn't look amazed. And Scarpetta begins to see something else peek out from Mrs. Paulson, some other creature that coils within.
My phone hardly stops ringing. A lot of reporters, a whole lot of those people. They were here the other days.
She turns around in her chair, indicating the front of the house.
In a big TV truck with this tall antenna, or whatever it is. It's indecent, really. Of course, this FBI agent was here the other day, and she said it's because no one knows what happened to Jilly. She said it's not as bad as it might be, whatever that means. She said she's seen a whole lot worse, and I don't know what could be worse.
Maybe she meant the publicity, Scarpetta says kindly.
What could be worse than what happened to my Jilly?
Mrs. Paulson asks, wiping her eyes.
What do you think happened to her?
Marino asks, his thumb stroking the rim of his coffee cup.
I know what happened to her. She died of the flu,
Mrs. Paulson replies.
God took her home to be with him. I don't know why. I wish someone would tell me.
Other people don't seem to be so sure she died of the flu,
Marino says.
That's the world we live in. Everybody wants drama. My little girl was in bed with the flu. A lot of people have died of the flu this year.
She looks at Scarpetta. Mrs. Paulson, Scarpetta says, your daughter didn't die of the flu. I'm sure you've been told this already. You talked to Dr. Fielding, didn't you?
Oh, yes. We talked on the phone right after it happened. But I don't know how you could tell if someone died of the flu. How could you possibly tell that after the fact when they're not coughing and don't have a fever and can't complain about how they're feeling?
She begins to cry.
Jilly had a temperature of 100 degrees and was about to choke from coughing when I went out to get more cough syrup. That's all I did. Drove to the CVS on Carey Street to pick up some more cough syrup.
Scarpetta glances at the bottle on the counter again. She thinks of the slides she looked at in Fielding's office just before she left for Mrs. Paulson's house. Microscopically, there were remains of fibrin and lymphocytes and macrophages in sections of lung tissue, and the alveoli were open. Jilly's patchy bronchopneumonia, a common complication of the flu, especially in the elderly and the young, was resolving and wasn't severe enough to impair lung function.
Mrs. Paulson, we could tell if your daughter died of the flu, Scarpetta says. We could tell from her lungs.
She doesn't want to go into graphic detail about how uniformly hard or consolidated and lumpy and inflamed Jilly's lungs would have been had she died of acute bronchopneumonia. Was your daughter on antibiotics?
Oh, yes. The first week she was.
She reaches for her coffee.
I really thought she was getting better. I just sort of thought she had a cold left, you know.
Marino pushes back his chair.
You mind if I let the two of you talk? He asks. I'd like to look around, if that's okay with you.
I don't know what there is to look at, but go ahead. You're not the first one to come in here and want to look around. Her bedroom's in the back.
I'll find it.
He walks off, his boots heavy on the old wooden floor. Jilly was getting better, Scarpetta says. The examination of her lungs shows that.
Well, she was still weak and puny.
She didn't die from the flu, Mrs. Paulson, Scarpetta tells her firmly. It's important you understand that. If she had died of the flu, I wouldn't need to be here. I'm trying to help, and I need you to answer some questions for me.
You don't sound like you're from around here.
From Miami, originally.
Oh, and that's where you still live? Real near it, anyway. I've always wanted to go to Miami, especially when the weather's like this, so gloomy and all.
She gets up to pour more coffee, and she moves with difficulty, her legs stiff as she walks across to the coffee maker near the bottle of cough syrup. Scarpetta imagines Mrs. Paulson restraining her daughter face down on the bed and doesn't rule it out as a possibility, but finds it an unlikely one. Mother doesn't weigh much more than her daughter did, and whoever restrained Jilly was sufficiently heavy and strong to prevent her from struggling enough to suffer more injuries than she has. But Scarpetta doesn't rule out that Mrs. Paulson murdered Jilly. She can't rule that out, as much as she might like to.
I wish I could have taken Jilly to Miami or Los Angeles or someplace special,
Mrs. Paulson is saying.
But I'm afraid to fly, and I get car sick, so I never have gone much anywhere. And now I wished I'd tried harder.
She slides out the coffee pot, and it trembles in her small, slender hand. Scarpetta keeps looking at Mrs. Paulson's hands and wrists and any areas of exposed skin, checking for any evidence of old scratches or abrasions or other injuries. But 2 weeks have passed. She jots a note on her notepad to find out if Mrs. Paulson might have had any injuries when the police responded to the scene and interviewed her.
I wish I had, because Jilly would have liked Miami. All those palm trees and pink flamingos,
Mrs. Paulson says. At the table, she refills their cups, and coffee sloshes in the glass pot as she returns it to the drip coffee maker, ramming it in a little too hard.
This summer, she was going to travel with her father.
She sits down wearily in the straight-back oak chair.
Maybe just stay with him in Charleston, if nothing else. She's never been to Charleston, either.
She rests her elbows on the table.
Jilly's never been to the beach, never seen the ocean except in pictures, and now and then on TV, although I didn't let her watch much TV. Can you blame me?
Her father lives in Charleston? Scarpetta asks, although she knows what she's been told.
Moved back there last summer. He's a doctor there. Lives in a grand house right there on the water. He's on the tour route, you know. People pay good money to walk in and look at his garden. Of course, he doesn't do a thing to that garden. Can't be bothered with such things as that. He hires whoever he wants to help him with things he can't be bothered with, like the funeral. He has lawyers screwing that all up, let me tell you. Just to get me, you know? because I want her here in Richmond, and for that reason he wants her in Charleston.
What kind of doctor is he?
A little of everything. A general practitioner. And he's a flight surgeon, too. You know, they have that big Air Force base in Charleston, and Frank has a line out his door every day, so he's told me. Oh, he brags about it enough. All these pilots dropping by to get their flight physicals for $70 each, so he does all right, Frank does.
She talks on, scarcely catching her breath between sentences and slightly rocking in her seat. Mrs. Paulson, tell me about Thursday, December 4th. Start with your getting up that morning. Scarpetta can see where this will go if she doesn't do something about it. Mrs. Paulson will talk in convolutions forever, sidewinding her way around questions and details that really matter and obsessing about her estranged husband. What time did you get up that morning?
I'm always up at 6, so I was up at 6. Don't even need an alarm clock because I've got one built in.
She touches her head.
You know, I was born at exactly 6 a.m., and that's why I wake up at 6 a.m., I'm sure of that.
And then what? Scarpetta hates to interrupt, but if she doesn't, this woman will talk in tangled digressions the rest of the day. Did you get out of bed?
Why, of course I got out of bed. I always do, come right here in the kitchen, fix my coffee. Then I go back to my bedroom and read the Bible for a while. If Julie has school, I have her out the door by 7:15 with her little lunch packed and all the rest, and one of her friends gives her a ride. For that, I'm lucky. She has a friend whose mother doesn't mind driving every morning.
Thursday, December 4th, 2 weeks ago, Scarpetta steers her back where she needs her. You got up at 6, made coffee, and returned to your room to read your Bible? Then what? She asks, as Mrs. Paulson nods affirmatively. You sat in your bed and read the Bible? For how long?
A good half hour.
Did you check on Jilly?
I prayed for her first, just let her sleep in while I prayed for her. Then, around 7:15, I went in, and she was lying in bed all wadded up in the covers, just sleeping to beat the band.
She starts crying.
I said, Jilly, my little baby Jilly, wake up and let's get you some hot cream of wheat. And she opened those pretty blue eyes of hers and said, Mama, I was coughing so much last night my chest hurts. That's when I realized we were out of cough syrup.
She stopped suddenly, staring with wide, runny eyes.
Funny thing about it is, the dog was barking and barking. I don't know why I never thought of that until now.
What dog? Do you have a dog? Scarpetta makes notes, but doesn't make a big production out of it. She knows how to look and listen and lightly jot a few words in a scrawl that few people can read.
That's the other thing,
Mrs. Paulson says, and her voice jumps and her lips tremble as she cries harder.
Sweetie ran off. Dear God in heaven.
She cries harder and rocks harder in her seat.
Little Sweetie was out in the yard when I was talking to Jilly, and then later she was gone. The police or ambulance didn't shut the gate, as if it wasn't bad enough, as if everything wasn't bad enough.
Scarpetta slowly closes the leather notebook and sets it and the pen on the table. She looks at Mrs. Paulson. What kind of dog is Sweetie?
She was Frank's, and he couldn't be bothered. He walked out, you know, not even 6 months ago on my birthday. How's that for a fine thing to do to another human being? And he said, you keep Sweetie, unless you want her to end up at the Humane Society.
What kind of dog is Sweetie?
He never cared for that dog. And you know why? Because he doesn't care about anybody but himself, that's why. Now Jilly loves that dog. Oh, my, does she? If she knew.
Tears run down her cheeks, and her tongue is small and pink as it rolls out and licks her lips.
If she knew, it would just break her little heart.
Mrs. Paulson, what kind of dog is Sweetie, and have you reported her missing?
Reported?
She blinks, her eyes focusing for an instant, and she almost laughs when she blurts out,
to who? To the police who let her out? Well, I don't know that you call it reporting exactly, but I did tell one of them. I can't say who. One of them, anyway. I said, my dog's missing.
When was the last time you saw Sweetie? And Mrs. Paulson, I know how upset you are, I really do. But if you could please try to answer my questions.
What's my dog got to do with you, anyway? Seems like a missing dog isn't any of your concern unless maybe it's dead. And even then, I don't think doctors the type you are do much about dead dogs.
I'm concerned about everything. I want to hear everything you can tell me. Just then, Marino is in the kitchen doorway. Scarpetta didn't hear his heavy feet. She is startled that he can carry his formidable mass on those big-booted feet, and she doesn't hear a thing. Marino, she says, looking right at him, you know anything about their dog? Their dog's missing. Sweetie, she's a... What kind is she? She looks to Mrs. Paulson for help.
A basset hound? Just a baby,
she sobs.
Doc, I need you for a minute, Marino says.
End of Disc 4.